very clear to me that it was time to get out and move on. I still had a few years left in the military, and I decided it's time to start writing. You had to be good at fighting. You had to be good at hunting. Otherwise, guess what? You were dead. Today, we're so far removed from that. Go to www.hunting.com and then just follow the instructions. Like, I don't think so. It's more personal than that. You can't just look at a tweet and then that it all of a sudden becomes the basis for your belief system. And use that experience. It can transition into wisdom as I move forward and find my next mission in life. This is Jack Carr, former Navy SEAL, current author, and you're listening to The Wild Initiative.
Put down your latte and pull on your boots.
I would rest at peace for eternity if my legacy was that I made a positive influence on the non-hunting public about what hunters are and what hunting is.
I finally got my buck on our last real day of hunting.
So a pro-hunting organization is voting against hunting. And that says anti-hunting to me.
There was a year straight where I was averaging up to 200 death threats a day.
I hugged it. Like, I just wanted to hug a bear.
It's proven that the average steak in a grocery store touches 50 to 100 hands and machines. And we're putting that into our body.
Hey, y'all. Cable Smith, host of the Lone Star Outdoors Show here.
This is Adam Weatherby.
I'm Corey Jacobson with Elk 101.
This is Christy Titus.
Hey, folks. This is John Bear.
You're listening to The Wild Initiative.
Hey, y'all, welcome to another episode of The Wild Initiative, brought to you as part of the Waypoint Outdoor Collective. All right, y'all, so getting on to today's episode, I'm super, super excited about this guest. Today, I have Jack Carr, author, hunter, former Navy SEAL, on the podcast with me. Y'all, I've been obsessively reading his series lately. And so I'm hoping after the podcast, he might give me a hint at what's to come next, but we'll find out about that later. But Jack, thanks so much for taking the time to hop on with me today.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me on. I love talking books, love talking reading, love talking hunting. So, this is my type of podcast.
You know, I feel like this is one of those podcasts that I really have no idea where it's going to go because there's so many little routes we can take, and I'm hoping we hit a little bit of everything. So we'll see. But, you know, what I always like to start out with is, you know, and there's a lot of ways we could go about this, but just kind of an introduction of generally who you are and what you do. But then also with that, how did you get introduced to the outdoors and hunting and fishing and all of this?
Yeah. So I guess the best way to start is just for a little background is from the beginning, which is I always wanted to serve my country in uniform. That's all I can ever remember wanting to do from a very early age. And I think a lot of that comes from just knowing that my grandfather was killed in World War II. The day we're recording this actually is December 7th. And of course, 1941, that was the attack on Pearl Harbor. And I just grew up with his medals and his silk maps they used to give aviators back then. Because if you hit the water in your plane back then, had a paper map, it would obviously, you know, disintegrate in the water, but a silk map would not. His wings, old black and white photos of his squadron. So very early on, I knew that was my path. And then also very early on, I found out about SEALs and what frogmen were and special operations and all that. Did a lot of research. My mom was a librarian, so I grew up surrounded by books and a love of reading and knew that, wow, one day, okay, these SEAL guys sound pretty tough. And the training, it says in this book here, this article or this paragraph that I'm reading here at age 7, says that there's some of the toughest training ever designed by a modern military. So I'm in. So I was always on that path. And then also because my mom was a librarian and I loved reading, I naturally gravitated towards fiction whose authors had protagonists that had backgrounds that I wanted to have in real life one day. And typically back then in the 80s, it was guys with Vietnam experience, either in the SEAL teams or in special forces or as some sort of a CIA program, something like that. And so I just had such a great experience reading these novels that I knew that one day I would also try my hand at that. And I'd write thrillers of the same genre that I was reading growing up. So I just knew that those were the two things that I was going to do with my life. And then we were always just an outdoor family growing up. We didn't grow up hunting. I grew up shooting, but not necessarily hunting. And we'd go to the Sierras, primarily Northern California, and spend a ton of time in the outdoors. And just any chance I got, I was always headed outside. That was just life in our family. So a lot of reading and a lot of time spent outside, and all that, those things kind of overlap, because I love reading books about the outdoors, love reading books about the military, both fiction and non. And so that was my introduction to the outdoors, was just through my parents getting us outside, and then never wavered. So all the things that I was growing up, I still am today. You know, all my friends from from kindergarten on, and I still have those friends. Actually, I have a friend from preschool still. They're like, yeah, you're the exact same person now that you were in preschool, which is, it's kind of cool to me, I guess.
That is wild. I had an old preschool teacher that I ran into, and I knew who it was, and I was like, yeah, I mentioned it was, I used to be one of your students. She full on remembered who I was out of the blue, called me by name. Wow. I was blown away. So apparently, I guess I'm pretty close to the same kid I used to be, but
that's awesome.
So where, you mentioned your family's from Northern California.
Yeah. So I grew up in Northern California, and just always, yeah, we grew up, just always going up into the Sierras and spend some time up there.
What area, Northern California?
Just north of San Francisco, up that area. Northern California.
Coastal. I get you.
So yeah, I grew up doing all that stuff and getting outside. We fished a lot as a family, but didn't really get into. I always knew I was drawn toward hunting, but my dad just didn't hunt. Like, we'd go to the range, we'd shoot. We had old 22s and 30-30s and shotguns and stuff like that, but we never, I always wanted to, and I was always jealous of my friends who were going hunting with their dads. I was always like, oh man, I want to go do that. And we just didn't do it as a family. So really I got into hunting. I mean, I was into it, but didn't do it until later on in life. And that was through sniper sustainment training at SEAL Team 5, pre-September 11th. They wanted to get us into a place, like, we spent a lot of time in sniper school. You're on the range and then doing the stalking portions of the course as well. But around that time, they really wanted to get us out hunting. They wanted us to put bullets into things that were living and breathing. So we went to a place up in Northern Washington State. I don't think they have really advertised that they do it up there, so I'll just keep it to Northern Washington State. But a beautiful area up there. It was such an amazing experience. So I got my first deer up there. You know, we're hanging it, slicing off pieces, throwing it on the grill. And it was just something I'd always wanted to do, but that was really my first experience doing it. And then I was all in after that. And then we kept doing that, some sniper sustainment stuff through the military, which was great. And then my daughter, she's all naturally gravitated towards hunting without any kind of encouragement for me, other than having like the Outdoor Channel on when she was younger. And she just gravitated towards weapons and wanting to go outside and hunt. So I was, of course, like, yeah, let's do it. So we became a hunting family, and we've got all the kids out there and my wife, and every year. This year was crazy. We didn't get out this year, unfortunately, but we've gotten out every year multiple times over the past few years, and pretty much all we eat is not all we eat, but primarily is wild game. And so it's great, especially for our daughter, who's now 15, but she got her first deer at age 7, and she had quite the experience bringing home deer and elk. It's just two amazing elk. But to bring those back out, obviously, and then talk about that experience and remember it together, particularly as a family, or as a father-daughter experience, or father-son experience now with our littlest guy. So being able to take that out and toss it on the grill and relive those experiences is it's primal and it's visceral, and it helps connect you as a family, not just to each other, but to the land and your meal as well.
That's one of the amazing things, and definitely one of the more unique, uncommon ways I've had people come on the podcast and tell me they've been introduced to hunting. That is definitely a first, I believe. It's amazing. And, you know, we talk about introducing people to hunting a lot, but you never know that one person that it's really going to change. And then suddenly it becomes a lifestyle for them. You may just think like, oh, it's just this random person that I'm taking along with me on this hunt or whatever it may be. And it could end up being that down the line, then their whole family, you know, that ends up being something that turns into a passion and a tradition for them and their whole family. And it just grows exponentially.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully it's something they pass on to their kids. And obviously it's not just the hunting and the fishing, it's disconnecting today from all these devices that that keep us plugged in, especially the kids. So being able to go places where there's no cell service and no Wi-Fi, and those places are obviously getting harder and harder to find. But typically where we go hunting, you don't have great service. We also try to do a river rafting trip every year because in the base of these river canyons, guess what? No Wi-Fi, no cell service. So there's no, and it goes for me too, not just for the kids. It's, there's no even me looking at my phone saying, hey, hold on 1 second. I just gotta return this quick text. Hold on 1 second to the kids. That's not even an option because I'm so used to just being connected as I'm building, you know, it's essentially a small business in the publishing industry is hold on 1 sec. And I just hate to do that. So being able to be someplace where that's not even an option is something that's very valuable to me. And of course, they're getting that self-reliance piece. They're learning to be safe with firearms. They're learning a tradition that they can pass on to their kids. And of course, you know, we know where the food is coming from, what it's eating that we put on our table. So there's just so many benefits to it. And yeah, I feel very fortunate that we've been able to get out and run a lease down in Texas and part owner of a hunting operation in Hawaii called Pineapple Brothers on Lanai, which is axe to steer, mouflon sheep. So that's amazing to be able to go out there. And that's a great family experience too, because, you know, sometimes maybe my wife doesn't want to rough it so much. she has, that's for sure, but she might prefer staying at the Four Seasons and being able to go to Nobu for dinner. But also going out to hunt and bring access to your home. It's just such an amazing experience out there. It's such a part of the culture and part of that island. And so that's pretty cool to do as well.
Well, you know, it's really funny. I didn't realize that you were a part of, I'm super familiar with Pineapple Brothers. We took a family trip to Hawaii, and this was back when I was working full time, and my family's like, okay, you know, we want to do this. And so save your vacation time. I'm like, all right, here's the deal though. A vacation in Hawaii is a very different idea to me than it is to you guys. And there's some things I want to do. And they're like, hey, as long as we can have dinner at some point, do whatever you want. So I was very close, and I ended up just not being able to swing it at the time. But I was very close to doing some axis deer hunting while I was out there on vacation. And it's still something I definitely want to do and want to take some time. I hear the meat is just some of the best on earth. Like,
yeah, no, it's incredible. And we have Bob the Butcher out there, who's kind of like Rogan has turned into like a mini celebrity. Him and his wife run the butcher kind of out of their house shop or out there. Anyway, it's such a cool experience, but each of the islands are so distinctly different, which is what's amazing about Hawaii. So really, I've only hunted Lanai, but I want to hunt the other islands. And having been to the other islands, having been to Kauai and been to Maui and been to the Big Island and been to Oahu and all that, they're just so distinctly different from one another, which is really cool. And then easy to get to also. There's direct flights from Salt Lake, which is great because we're in Park City, Utah now. And then obviously from the West Coast, there's other direct flights out there, probably some from Seattle, I don't know. But yeah, so it's an easy place for the West Coast to get to. A little harder for the East Coast to get out there, but West Coast, man, you can get some work done too. Hop on that plane and start getting some work done. So it's a pretty cool experience.
It's, you know, Hawaii is one of those really unique places where there's like opportunity year round, and it's really not, it's not like you have to wait 4 years to draw the right tag, and you can pretty much go out any time of year and go hunt a bunch of different things, you know, whether it's wild goat or hog, or, you know, we did spearfishing out there. There's
super cool.
There's some amazing opportunities, some fun stuff you just don't get anywhere else.
Yeah, no, amazing. Yeah, exotics. So it's all year long. And people ask me, hey, what's the best time of year to go out there? And it's so hard to say, because you could go in the quote unquote best time and have like just rain the whole entire time, you know, and then you could go at the worst time and have just beautiful weather. So it's tough for, you know, to be able to say, and I've been there multiple times, all different months of the year. And it's just, it's awesome all the time. You just never know what you're going to get out there. And that's part of it. You have to go in with that. If you go to Hawaii, you have to go in with it with that kind of that expectation, but that understanding that, hey, you just don't know about the weather. It's just kind of how it goes. And then on Lanai, which is the island I'm more familiar with now, is that there's three distinct temperate zones there. So it's really, really crazy. You know, the Serengeti type plain type thing where the axis really hang out. And then you get to these almost mountainous, really lush jungle type temperate zone where the mouflon sheep are. And it's just a cool place to go in general.
I think it's definitely one of those things. I feel like if you are a hunter and it's your passion and it's kind of like what you obsess over, it's your thing. I definitely feel like a trip to Hawaii for axis and the sheep and goat and all of that. I feel like it has to be on your bucket list somewhere, you know.
And you can bring your family, which is great if they're not hunters, or if they're just thinking about it. It's not a bad place to introduce them to hunting. But then they might get used to it. They might think that all hunting is done out of the four seasons, which is obviously not the case. And what's also cool is I can incorporate some of these trips into the research for my novels now. So I got to go to Kamchatka Peninsula because I knew that my third novel, Savage Son, was going to have this part that took place in Kamchatka in Siberia. And I knew I had to put boots on the ground, even though I'd read a ton about it. I just knew I had to put boots on the ground because you get so much more by doing that you can't research. You don't even know you need to research it if you're just doing it from your computer until you put your boots on the ground there. You talk to the people, you get some stories, you get that local flavor that you can weave in. So I did a brown bear hunt over there, which was just crazy. And then for the second and also the third as well, I went to Mozambique and then down into South Africa later to help train up an anti-poaching unit with Glocks and M4s because I have some experience with those weapon systems and they're protecting some of the last rhino on earth down there. So I really wanted to get the tracking stuff from them, which was cool. So it's fun for me to be able to do that. But also when I started down this path, hunting was very much at the forefront of my mind because I want someone to pull that book from the shelf as they're walking through the airport and pass by Hudson News and see it. And maybe they heard about it from somebody or heard it on a podcast or whatever, but they think they're grabbing a political thriller. They think they're grabbing like a spy type novel. And what they are getting that off the shelf, but they're also getting a little bit of an education in hunting and conservation because I weave those into the storyline, sometimes subtly, sometimes not so subtly. So I wanted to do that as well because I really hadn't seen that done before in the thriller space. If it had been done, it was done by somebody that is interviewing a hunter about a place. And then just like if you're interviewing like a Navy SEAL sniper about it as an author, you're taking notes. Well, whatever that person is telling you, you're then filtering through your own life experience, your own biases, your own other research to then put it into a fictional narrative. So for me, I don't have to interview that person because I can just remember what it was like going into Ramadi in 2006, like at the height of the war as a sniper. And I can take that experience and then apply that to a totally fictional narrative. But I think that's what made it stand out to Simon & Schuster, who sees thousands of these things every year, is that it feels real. The emotions that the protagonist is feeling feel raw, feel real, because they are, because they come from a real place. It's not just me thinking about what it would be like in some of these situations and how it would feel. It's my actual feelings and emotions applied to a fictional novel. So I think that made it stand out to Simon & Schuster and to readers as well, because I hear all the time how real and raw the experience of reading these novels is. So, but that applies to the hunting space as well. My point is that being able to have gone to Africa, go to Mozambique, go to Kamchatka Peninsula, wherever else, and then have that experience with the people, with with the different traditions, hunting traditions in these different places, I can then apply those to the novels, and it works in the same way as the military experience does.
Well, and that's one thing, you know, and that's perfect because I wanted to bring that up, and that's one thing I've really, really noticed throughout all three books so far is just that those little details here and there that you can tell that you're like, oh yeah, no, he actually does this and has been there. You know, you'll mention a brand here and there, and whether it's talking about the specific red dot site you're using or the brand of camo, or I say you're using, James Reese is using.
One and the same.
I was gonna say that was something else that I was gonna ask you. I'm like, all right, how much are you and James Reese? How much crossover is there? And I can only imagine, you know, he's a fictional character nonetheless, yeah. But you've got to have poured a lot of yourself into that character because it's based on so many experiences you've had.
Yeah, no, it's very, very personal. And when the reader meets James Reese in the first novel, he's planning to come back from his last deployment and then get out and take care of his family because that's the last time he's going to tactically maneuver guys on the battlefield. He's a prior enlisted Navy SEAL sniper, becomes an officer, and now he's in this leadership role where if he stays in, then yeah, he'll come back as a commanding officer at some point. But in today's military, yeah, you come back as a commanding officer, you're still leading, but you're leading from the tactical operations center. You're in management at that point. You're a managing leader. You're not out there kicking doors with the guys, and the guys don't want you kicking doors with them at that point. You haven't done the workup. You don't know the SOPs. You're just stumbling around, getting in the way at that point. So you kind of age yourself out of doing what most of us came in to do in the military, which is kick those doors and do those missions. So there's a transition there. And for me, when I came back from my last deployment to Iraq, I knew that was the last time I was going to tactically lead guys in the battlefield. I was a prior enlisted SEAL sniper, then I became an officer, and I was at task unit commander, which is an 04, which is a lieutenant commander, which is for all the other services as a major. But if I stayed in, I was going to end up in one of those management positions. And my family needed me. We have three kids, and it was time, very clear to me that it was time to get out and move on. I still had a few years left in the military, but I was going to my last assignment as a shore duty type thing, and I decided it's time to start writing. But that's the exact point where the reader meets James Reese. He drives 1988 Land Cruiser, which I also happen to drive. I don't know if you use Land Cruisers. I had that same background. He's much better at jujitsu than I am. He's a much better boxer. He's a much better sniper. He's much faster and stronger and wittier, of course. So there is a lot of crossover there. A lot of things that I can think back on or delve into to create the character, to build the character. And same thing. That's why I use the gear for. Mm-hmm. Some people like it, some people don't, but it's very natural for me to use gear because I'm a gear person. I was growing up, was in the military, and I continue to be today. So it would be odd for me just to say that he had a gun in a holster. Like, I just couldn't do it. I have to, like, that tells a story. Like, if I see you and we meet in person and you walk in and I see what you're carrying, oh, is it a Kydex or is it a Glock or is it leather with a 1911? Something like, there you go, nice. You know, so all that stuff tells a story. You know, what kind of blade is in his pocket there? What does that tell me about him? So all these little things are data points in real life. And so I use them as data points to develop my characters as well. So yeah, in the first, I hear from a lot of hunters, they read the first chapter in what's really the prologue to The Terminal List, my first novel. And they're like, oh man, sick of camo. And there's a rifle made by this guy, Darcy Eccles, down here in Utah. And they're like, oh, no way. Or they look it up and they're like, oh my gosh, it's a real thing. So it's kind of cool. And also I grew up with Jonathan Hart at Sitka. So I got to be a part of that evolution of that company from before day one, and just watch how he came up with that idea, of course. And of course, people have been talking about it forever, but he's the one that actually did it and made hunting clothing technical. You didn't have to go to Cabela's and, you know, get a big boxy thing that you could use the same designers from Patagonia and Arc'teryx and North Face at the time and all that sort of thing to build out and really change the hunting industry. So I have a lot of respect, and I'm always fascinated by people or companies that change industries regardless, because they take a risk or they have an idea or they develop an idea based on their experience up to that point, their knowledge up to that point, and then share that with other people, with other businesses. So that so there's Sitka in every book because of that. There's Black Rifle Coffee in every book. So there's just stuff that I like and enjoy that I weave into the storyline, which is something that's very natural for me to do.
You know, I think the gear stuff too is, it's one of those things that people can identify with too. And it adds a little bit of excitement because, I mean, there's a lot of gear in the books. Like, he goes through a couple of guns here and there without giving away too much. He goes through a number of different types of gear, and it just gives people an opportunity to connect with the character on a different way. And it's right. Like, you talk about the gear in a certain way and you say two different things. You know, you say something like, you know, he unsheathes his K-bar, you know, and this is simplifying it. He unsheathes his K-bar versus he flicks open his Benchmade. It tells you a completely different story. If you know what those two pieces of gear are, it tells you about the man, what he's about to do. Like, it, you know, and I'm such a vivid imagination when I read. I'm the guy that I'll get into a book and people have full conversations with me and I won't even realize they're there.
Yeah.
I'm immersed. Like there could be a war going on around me. I would never know it.
Yeah. Yeah, very cool. Yeah, one of the things, like, we're going back to hunting and the kids and all that stuff. So we recently moved, which is my, for people that have watched the podcast, some people before, whatever, that's background's different because we're surrounded by boxes and insanity, which means I left my smoker at the last house because the people that wanted to buy it, they wanted it. And thank goodness, because it means I didn't have to carry it up this cliff this level that was built into this like cliff thing. It was crazy. But so we got this thing called a birch barrel, and you're in Montana right now. And I discovered this birch barrel thing at Total Archery Challenge last year.
I have one out back.
Yeah. So I got mine right before Thanksgiving. You know, I set it up and I was like, amazing. I set it up. Sometimes I mess stuff up like that, put stuff on back. Anyway, so I got that thing up. No problem. Awesome. The kids roasted some marshmallows. Next morning I made some breakfast on it, some eggs and sausages. And then Thanksgiving, like it was the first test. The first real test was Thanksgiving. And I was like, oh man, I'm going to jack this up. Like it's going to be totally dry. Like I just don't see this working out. It was the best turkey we've ever had. Better than our fryer, better than our smoker, better than the oven. It was so awesome. And you could totally tell, and everybody could tell, and all of them thought I was going to mess it up too. Everybody thought I was going to jack it up. Like, we put this new contraption together. We're doing it with fire. You're out there adjusting things. You know, you're adding wood. Derek, you're totally messing this up. Nope. Boom. Splayed the thing open with this thing, which is pretty sweet. I'm talking about here. This, I don't know how I've survived this long without an antique cleaver or a cleaver of any type. So this was made in the 1800s in Pennsylvania in the golden age of steel by New West Knife Works. And they do these refurbished cleavers, which are awesome. And so I splayed that thing open with this, and someone might meet their end with this in a future novel. It was just so sick.
It's too good.
Yeah. So I did that and then threw it on the birch barrel, left it for an hour and 45 minutes. And I was adjusting things, of course, and, you know, playing around with it. Best trick we've ever had. Awesome.
I just had the greatest picture of James Reese out back grilling when some assassination squad comes to and that thing just going end over end right into somebody's
You might take that thing, you know, dump it or put somebody's head in it. Who knows? All sorts of creative ways to for people to meet their demise.
So many creative ways to kill people.
Yep.
oh man, but you know, one of the things I did love about the second novel is, and again, without really giving away any of the story, because there's so many great, fantastic twists and turns throughout the whole book. And I'm such a sucker for these kind of novels because I love all those twists and turns. But the conservation messaging you weave throughout the whole, especially, it's really prevalent in the second, mm-hmm. in the second novel, just because of where James Reese is and what he's doing. And I'd like to quote a section from the book here that I just really stuck out to me. And it's talking about conservation and Rich and James are talking together. And he says, the general public in Europe and the States don't see the difference between what we do and what the poachers do. Without us here, the game would be gone. We're out there protecting it because it has value to our business. Sure. But we love this place and these animals. We manage and conserve it for the next generation. The poachers, on the other hand, would wipe out the game in a year or two if we let them have their go. And then they talk about what happened in Kenya and how hunting was banned, and without hunters in the field, suddenly all the game loses its value and begins to disappear. And I'd love for you to talk about that a little bit, because it's such like this section of the book. You can see here, I have it like the whole chunk highlighted because it's so clearly and concisely explains what people even in the hunting community don't understand about hunting in Africa, because I feel like that's the one thing where you can get hunters head to head on is African big game hunting.
I know it's tough sometimes, and that's always trying to weave that in through the characters, through the development of the characters, but also educate the person reading it. And it's something that is important to me to do, obviously. And people reach out all the time. They're like, they want to know more about this Hastings family because some of them move over. They're in all the books, but a little bit in the first one, much more in the second, more in the third as well. So people want more of those characters, which is really cool for me to hear.
Spinoff novel, maybe?
we shall see. But that second one was important for me also, to take James Reese on a journey, because he had to learn to live again. And because there's three books and a fourth coming out, it's not really a spoiler. It was in the beginning. If you were reading the first book for the first time and there was no other books out there, like, you didn't really know what was going to happen. But now if you like find out four or three, you know, and then go back to the first one, you kind of know a little bit more than you would have when the book first came out in 2018. But my experience with transition was my military experience, and not just mine, but watching people transition from the military, specifically special operations, and even more specifically the SEAL teams, and try to leave that life behind and start again in the private sector, or continue moving, but do so out of the military and into the private sector. And I saw so many people have a hard time doing that. And that's because I think, anyway, that they wanted to recreate kind of those same feelings that they had in the SEAL teams on the outside. And you're not going to be able to do that. You're not going to be able to be shoulder to shoulder with your best friends in the world, who are also your teammates, who are also trained to this very high level, who have a mission to go and capture or kill someone downrange. You don't have to worry about the bills. You don't have to worry about getting the kids to school on time, or changing a diaper, or fixing a leaky faucet. None of that. You are only focused on the task at hand, downrange, where your adversary wants to kill you. So on the outside, you're just not going to find that. So you have to accept that as you make these transitions, that, hey, this next transition, this next chapter in life is not going to be the same. I'm not going to have those same feelings. But you know what's important is I can build off the experience, whether it was good or bad, in the military, and I can move forward. I can use that experience. It can transition into wisdom as I move forward and find my next mission in life, find my next passion in life. So I took all that and applied it to my character, James Reese, who thinks that he's dying and he needs to find that next mission in life, that next purpose in life. And he does so in Africa, because he's going off the grid and needs to find some place where he thinks he's going to die. And this is a place that he knows of, that's about as far off the grid as he can possibly imagine, thinks he's going to die on the way there, and gets there. But throughout that journey, and then once he sets foot in Africa, he finds this next mission, this next passion, and he can use what he learned in the military to combat the poaching problem in Africa. So he takes those lessons learned from Iraq and Afghanistan and applies them to the poaching problem in Africa. So all that's woven in, but was very important in my evolution as an author to not just take what was successful in the first book and plop it down in another country. Like, oh, Mission of Revenge, very cut and dry. I'm going to take that and I'm going to apply it, put it in Europe. I'm going to put it in Africa. I'm going to put it in China. And I'm just going to morph things a little bit because it worked the first time. And I didn't want to just be looked at as like a one trick pony. I really wanted to evolve, really wanted the character to evolve, to go on this journey and really get him to a place where then I could write about what I write about in Savage Son, my third novel, because that's the one I wanted to write first. But I knew that the characters weren't developed enough to get to that place where I could explore that theme of the dark side of man to the dynamic of hunter and hunted. That's what I wanted to do. But I knew I couldn't come out of the gate with it. I had to come out of the gate with the terminal list, hard-hitting, visceral, primal, and frankly, one I thought was most likely to get noticed by a New York publishing house. And then I knew that at the end of that novel, not quite ready yet for what happens in Savage Son, the character needs to evolve. He needs to learn to live again, needs to find that mission. And so that's a little longer first part of the journey in that one. And that's where a lot of that conservation and Africa hunting stuff takes place. But then he gets to apply that to hunting down people and terrorists. But then at the end of that one, I knew that James Reese was ready. He was involved enough as a character. I brought the readers far enough along where they'd be interested in this next novel, Savage Son, which really I was inspired to write in the sixth grade when I read The Most Dangerous Game by Richard Connell, which most hunters have either heard of or read. And it's just a great short story. You can read it in like 30 minutes. Really, the third novel, Savage Son, pays tribute to Richard Connell's Most Dangerous Game that I read all those years ago.
I really feel like you know, I was talking about this and how we have different campaigns that explain what is so important, not only to us about hunting, but to wildlife as well. And I've talked about this in podcasts before, but it's tough because one of the problems we always have is we're always just preaching to each other. You know, we're standing in front of the mirror, or we're standing in front of the choir and preaching, you know, what we're hearing right back at us. And it's not beneficial. And so I think guys like you, men and women like you, that have an audience that's going to be wider reaching. And yeah, okay, you never know, but let's just face it, the liberal leftist vegan is probably not going to pick up a copy of The Terminal List. Maybe they see it in the airport lobby and just need a book, but you know, there is going to be a somewhat of an audience that's going to pick this up, and they're going to probably be more open to it. But having someone like you that weaves a message like that in a very non-preachy, it's not preachy, it's not loud and obnoxious. It's so subtle. It's almost like it's almost subliminal in that messaging. You don't even realize that you're getting an education on conservation.
That was the goal. It was like what a little I could do to kind of help the cause or to educate people on some things that they become much too far removed from. And I talk about that in the preface to Savage Son, is that, you know, for only this slimmest portion of human history have we been able to not have to be good at fighting to defend our families, to defend ourselves, to defend the tribe, community, neighborhood. And have we not had to be good at hunting, or we could just go down to the store. I mean, it's such a small portion of human history. So it's important for me to explore that part as well. But I think so many people are disconnected from the land, disconnected from where their food comes from, disconnected from the skills that their forefathers had to have had, because if they didn't, they would not be here today. Like, you had to be good at fighting, you had to be good at hunting, otherwise guess what, you were dead. So somebody in everyone's line was good at these things, or maybe they were very good at making alliances, you know, and they were good at the cooking piece or something. But regardless, today we're so far removed from that. So but I think there's still that spark in everybody, just like that theme of revenge for the first novel. I chose that one because I loved reading books about revenge growing up. I loved movies about revenge. People are just naturally drawn to that theme for whatever reason, but it's such a primal notion and a primal thing to explore. If you're wronged, if you are attacked back at the beginning of time, you know what you did? Oh, well, you went out and you killed that person. And to make sure they wouldn't attack you again, or whatever it may be. So there's something in all of us that connects with. Same thing with hunting. And so I think even though people don't realize it, maybe as they're reading through these things, if they've never hunted before, they've never taken a jiu-jitsu class, they've never picked up a weapon, but there's something in them that it's just so primal that connects them to that storyline, that connects them to the fight, that connects them to the hunt. And I think there's really something to that. And to have gone down range in the SEAL teams and to be a hunter and being able to take those and apply them to these novels, I think there's something to it. I mean, I'm not certain, obviously, but I think that there is. And I love exploring all those themes. So there'll be common themes that find their way into the rest of the novels as well, because it's just very natural for me to incorporate that, because it's something I'm always thinking about. It's something that's such a part of me and my family, that for me not to incorporate those sorts of things would just be strange.
It's, you know, there's one more quote that I'd love to share from the book, because it so concisely just shares, I think, how many of us feel about hunting. And, you know, again, from True Believer, Reese is out with the guides, and they came across an animal that some poachers had snared, and Reese just took a shot and took down the animal. And it says, though putting a finger to trigger or knocking an arrow and bringing a bow to full draw was the culmination of one's training and preparation, it wasn't something Reese celebrated. Instead, after sending a bullet or releasing an arrow, he'd approach the animal quietly, kneel to place his hand on the creature he'd taken to provide for his family. He respected the wild others much more than the men he'd put in the ground. It's one of those amazing things to where yeah, there's excitement in the hunt. There's joy in being in the outdoors and providing for your family. But I mean, I think, you know, even Fred Bear, like the father of bow hunting, talked about it. There's joy and there's sorrow with that. You've taken a life, and there's respect as well that's involved in that. And that brings across the message so well. And it really, again, it just concisely explains to people, and they read that. And I hope as people read these books, they begin to associate that sort of attitude more so than the drunken kind of redneck behavior that people think of from the movies when they think of hunting, because I feel like that better encompasses more of what the hunting community is about.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It's and that's how I feel. Obviously, that's the character that I'm most closely, you know, associated with as I write these things, and what I apply my experience to is really his background and his thought process and his training and his mindset. But for me, getting out there, and when I do that, when I'm with other people or with an outfitter or something, and I take that shot. And sometimes I think they sometimes think it's strange that I don't all of a sudden just like, yeah, start celebrating when it drops. So I'm very, and I've always been that way. It's my first shot on an animal. Take that shot, boom, get another round in there. You know, maybe you need a follow up, maybe you don't, but you're ready. Okay. And then when I approach it, it's very strange. I don't think I've ever talked about this on a podcast before, but I approach it like I do a human, in that I want to be out of their line of sight. And approach the person from that direction, just so they're not, you're not sure. You're gathering information as you approach that person. If they're facing you, you gotta move offline so they can't see me as I approach, that sort of thing. If the person's just wounded or whatever else, maybe you have a partner that's holding and their focus is on them, and then you're coming around to do the cuffing and prisoner control and that sort of thing. But the same thing with an animal. You know, I approach that, I'm ready to go. That round is in there. Take my scope, dial it back to one or whatever, whatever it may be. And then I walk in and just quietly walk in out of that line of sight and to go about it from there. So it's, the celebratory jumping up and down, it's just not that it's anything wrong with it, but it's just not, you know, what I do. I get up there and then start doing the job, the rest of the job. But, and that was very natural for me to write about that for my protagonist as well.
It's, you know, and like you said, I don't think there's anything wrong with people that do celebrate. I'm not saying, you know, neither of us trying to say that that's a bad thing. Everyone has a different, I mean, it's a very visceral thing that just happened. Like, and for some people, that's their release. Like I know, that second it happened, you know, you don't realize how much tension and pressure is built up, you know, in your body and your mind and all of that. And it just releases. And for some people, it's a cheer. For other people, it's just like a sigh and you know, everything kind of focuses inward, but,
yeah, it's very personal thing. That's just mine. That's just my way. It's always been, I didn't think about it beforehand. You know, I never thought about, after I press this trigger, how am I going to feel or whatever, any of that sort of thing. It's just naturally what happened. So it's natural for me to then write about it, through my protagonist's eyes as well. Nothing wrong with the other. Everybody's going to have a different type of, reaction to, And if you wound an animal, it runs off, you know, it's a little different than if it just drops right away. And if it just drops right away and you start celebrating and then all of a sudden it pops up and runs off, well, then that's a different experience. And that's a different, that's a different lesson. So there's all sorts of things and ways, that you can go about, doing and feeling about these things. And that's just, you know, just my way. It's very natural for me to write about it through my protagonist's eyes.
So, yeah. And, you know, you mentioned a lot of people wanting to learn a lot more about the Hastings family. I would absolutely read a spinoff book about the Hastings, just throwing that out there, you know, especially, cause I picked up the, Three Sips of Gin or Two Sips.
Yeah, Three Sips of Gin. Yeah.
Three Sips of Gin. I picked that up and it's actually, I just started reading it about 2 days ago. So that's the next. And I'm thinking about this. I'm like, I want Jack to write a novel about this, like about this.
You get it all the time. It's so wild. And what's so cool about that is that in the third novel in Savage Son, there's a part where there's an attack on a ranch in Montana. And Caroline Hastings is the matriarch.
Oh, that was so badass. I just got to say, you guys, you got to read the series, but that was like the most, probably one of the most badass moments of the book was her.
Thank you. Yeah. And I got, and so it's based on a real person with a real last name of Hastings. And I thank her in the acknowledgments, and she's just awesome. Lives in Montana. She lent me a bunch of books. She grew up in Rhodesia, just like the character, came to the United States, was a Montana hunter. And she lent me a bunch of books that you can't really get in the States. And they were amazing. And I was going through these books as research, and I found this one story that has a matriarch of a family. The husband is off in the Bush Wars, doing their thing, Rhodesia back in the day. And their family farm is under attack. And the matriarch has this one line that she says to her daughter. And I took that line and I put it in the book. I morphed it a tiny bit, but I put it in the novel. And I thought someone was going to call me out on it and be like, and so I took a picture of that passage from this book, from this history of Rhodesia. And I took a picture of it. It's on my phone. And I thought someone was going to call me out and be like, yeah, no one's that tough. No one would ever say something like that. Huh. But it's true. It's an oral history of Rhodesia. And it was just so powerful when I read it. I knew I had to incorporate it, and I had to incorporate it into this character of Caroline Hastings in the novel. But it's just so powerful. It's one, I think it's probably one of my favorite lines from Savage Son. If I have to pick one, it's that line. I won't say what it is here, but it's so powerful. It just took me aback when I read it. I read it over and over and over again, and then I applied it to the novel, and it's just hard.
It is. That whole, I had to go back and keep rereading sections of it because I kept reading it so stinking fast that I was missing details, because it's just so, that whole like chapter of the book, you're just like, oh my gosh, what's going on right now? What's going on right now? You're like I'm trying to read the whole thing, but I'm like rushing through it because it's so just fast paced and action packed and everything's gnarly. I mean, I say that in pretty much the entire, all three books. There's not many slow sections in them. But yeah, I kept having to, that section of the book, I probably had to reread three times just to make sure I caught everything. But it was absolutely fantastic. Yeah. I'm like, I can't keep reading about the Hastings Ranch though, because I'm just living in Montana. That's it. I mean, come on.
No, it's so sweet. I need one of those places one day as well. But yeah, jumping back to the education piece, actually. So when I went to Mozambique, I didn't have a book deal, didn't have an agent. I knew I was always going to write two books though. And because I knew, because John Grisham, first he wrote A Time to Kill, and he couldn't give that book away. And then he writes The Firm. And The Firm's the one that takes off. And then we have a book by John Grisham every year since. And then they went back and published Time to Kill, which I think is arguably his best work. With me anyway, it resonates the most with me. So I always knew I was going to write two. And if both didn't work out, didn't find an audience, didn't get published, then I was going to reevaluate my life choices. But I'm always going to do two. So this is 2016. So I just retired from the military, jumped on a plane to Mozambique, and had a whole bunch of questions typed out that I wanted to ask over there. A bunch of different, he had to translate this into this language and this language and this language just to make sure I got that part right. Questions about, hey, make sure you take notes on the soil and the rocks and the plants and all this stuff. And I got much more that I didn't have on that list than I did after I went over there. But point being, 2016, so we're not that far removed from the big lion controversy that, I forget what year it was. But anyway, there's something, you can import lions back into the States. So I get over there and my PH, my professional hunter, shows me a bunch of pictures of what? Dead lions, poisoned lions, at watering holes, snared lions, because guess what? They have no value. Not only do they have no value, it's a negative, because they're killing livestock. They can kill people. They can kill, husbands, wives, kids, whatever. And over there, your walls aren't the same as they are here. yet we have people, and not just in New York, in LA, coffee houses. It's just an example of congratulating themselves about how they're saving the African lion, because now these evil hunters can't import them into the States. Well, guess what you guys just did? You just killed all these lions, not just the old male lions, which are the ones that you're going out there to go after, the ones that are done doing what they need to do. You're killing the babies, you're killing males, you're killing females. It doesn't matter. Indiscriminate killing of lions, because not only is there just no value, it's also doing damage by taking away those things that provide for your family, your livestock, and people. So people just don't think about that sort of thing. So I try to weave that in, bring a little awareness to it when it comes up, you know, naturally in an interview or something. It's not something I shy away from talking about, because I experienced it. And, you know, if these people really wanted to save African wildlife, they should go over there and not just go around and take a couple pictures and go home. That's a different experience than really being a part of the food chain, being out there, putting boots on the ground, walking, being part of that hunt. It's a different deal. Or going over there with someone that's doing that and talking to the people that are preserving some of the last, in the case of when I went back to South Africa, some of the last rhino on earth down there. And a lot of that's done with private donations and by private ranches, that sort of thing. So it's just interesting to not just read an article about it and then kind of rearticulate that maybe in your own words about why the ban on bringing lions back is hurting African wildlife. A little different to go over there to see the pictures, and I have them on my phone. I haven't posted them or anything, but just kind of need to figure out the most appropriate way to do that. But they're just dead lions by poison watering holes. The reason for that is because there's no value, and not just no value, but they're also bringing a negative impact to the families that actually live over there and don't call an exterminator every time they find a cockroach in their apartment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely doesn't. I think that's the one thing to note. It's not just that, yeah, okay, hunting adds value to the wildlife. Not only does it add value, it helps manage that wildlife that would otherwise be just exterminated as a nuisance. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, not to stereotype at all, but the people advocating, spending the most time advocating for the quote unquote protection of African wildlife look surprisingly like me and you, maybe without the beards, but maybe with curly mustaches or something. Wow. And probably spend a lot of time in Los Angeles coffee shops.
Congratulating themselves. Yeah, it's an interesting thing to, I guess, be so associated with maybe an ideology or belief system that makes you almost avoid some of the facts or just not be able to process them in a way that is logical. So you're congratulating yourself for something when, in fact, you've done the exact opposite of your intended purpose and your intended goal, your intended mission. You've done the exact 180 out. You've killed more lions than you saved, way more, and you haven't saved any. So it's an interesting thing. So but you know, you really have to, if you're interested in these things, just like with anything in life, you have to explore it. You have to read about it. You have to research it. You have to go there. You have to talk to people. You know, you can't just look at a tweet of however many characters you can put in a tweet, 200, whatever it is. And then that it all of a sudden becomes the basis for your belief system because someone tweeted out something about, you know, killing African wildlife. And then that is it. You have 200 plus words, and that is all characters, not words, sorry, characters. And that is your belief system for an entire species or an entire program designed to preserve wildlife on the planet. So it's crazy. And you really need to do the research, and you really need to go there. You really need to ask the right questions or ask any questions. And then come up and figure out if really that ban that you supported or that you championed, that you retweeted about, actually served its intended purpose, or if it did the exact opposite.
Do you have any resources you would recommend to someone that, other than actually going out and seeing it for yourself firsthand, any resources or places to look for information about this?
Gosh, you know, I don't have like one single place that I go to research these things. So I don't have a certain place like that. maybe some of the different organizations that have a goal of preserving African wildlife. Go check some of those websites and read some of what they have to say. But for me, I really do research really across the board, particularly as an author. I need to make sure that what I'm putting in the novels is factually correct, because people will call you out on it when you say pavement and they say, no, that's asphalt or whatever. Like, people will find these things like that, because everybody has a different area of expertise. And me as an author, that my area of expertise isn't different types of, you know, pavement and cement and asphalt or whatever. But I need to look into those things to do that research. So that applies to anything, really, whether it's something that quote unquote small or something very large, like the history of a terrorist organization or some of these impacts of hunting or that, whatever it might be. So I think it's important to go out there and do that research, immerse yourself in whatever it is that, whatever topic it is, before you jump to a conclusion based off someone else who also did no research other than retweet somebody else's 200 character tweet. So I think it's important to immerse yourself in whatever it is that you want to have an informed opinion about, process it, sleep on it, think about it, apply your experience to it, and then maybe talk about it. And as an author, I'm very fortunate that I have this time to research these novels. Oftentimes in interviews or if I'm posting about something, I don't have as much time, but I try to put as much thought into every single post as I do into the novel. If there's anything that I do, I try to put the requisite thought into it and put that requisite time into it. So because I think it's important for my readers to know that they can trust when they can trust that I've done that, regardless of what my opinion is on something. What I'm writing is that they know that I didn't just hear it from one person and then say it again real quick. It's, you know, I thought about these things. I researched these things. I got to think about them as I continued to write, got to do some more research as additional questions came up. And then for the most part, I try to go to the places that I write about, talk to the people that are there, and then apply those stories, apply that local flavor to the novels as well, which also then becomes part of our shared experience.
So we got some exciting stuff coming up. New novel is going to be coming out, as well as James Reese is being brought even more to life. Yeah. So we got the new novel. What's the title of the new novel?
Yeah, The Devil's Hand. So that comes out.
Here's a little card actually that has, it looks like that. The Devil's Hand.
So it comes out April 13th and finished that, the first round of edits. So this is, what is today? Monday. So on Friday, well, actually Saturday morning at 3 a.m, I finished the, cause that's the only time it's quiet around here. We have 3 kids and a dog and, you know, it's Christmas holiday coming up. It's just insane. So it's mass chaos at all times. So the only time it's really quiet is between maybe 10, 10:30, 11 and 3 a.m. So finished up the first round of edits here a couple of days ago. And the next thing I do is I print it out and I take a breath and then I come back to it, trying to read it through the eyes of someone who's experiencing it for the first time, who hasn't been intimately involved with its creation over the last year plus. And that's the part that's really the challenge for me, because I'm so intimately involved in it. And this one really explores something I've thought about for years and years and years during my time in the military, which was, hey, what is the enemy learning from us while they're watching us in Iraq and Afghanistan? So what are terrorist organizations learning? What are super empowered individuals learning? What's Russia learning? What's China learning? What's North Korea learning? What's Iran learning? Of course, they're a little more closely associated with us by what they've done through proxies from the early 80s up through today. But what are they learning? Essentially watching two football teams play and watching them for 20 years and then putting your team on the field in opposition to someone that you've seen, studied for all these years, watched how they've adapted over that time. So I really wanted to explore that. And I did that through the medium of biological weapons. So I was doing a lot of research on bioweapons, really from the end of World War II up through today, what happened to what the Japanese used in World War II, what they studied in World War II, what happened to their research at the end of the war, what happened to the German research at the end of the war, what did the Soviets do the early days of the Cold War up through their dissolution, and then what happened to all that information, all that research, all those doctors. What have we done? How have these biochem weapons treaties played in to that? So I explore, I was exploring all that sort of thing. And that's the devil's hand. So that's, trying to get that one out there, but so if you hadn't spent the last year researching these things and then applying our response to COVID, to that storyline as well, like if you hadn't been in so focused on that research and writing this novel, what would it read like to you? So I'm trying to look at it through the eyes of someone who's experiencing it for the first time here, make my edits, take another step back, probably print it again, read it through one more time, and then done. And it's time to move on to book five.
I mean, you know, if you need any assistance or feedback, I'm just saying.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Like I said, I'm a little bit anxious.
I'm super excited to get this out here. And then my mind's already, as I get close to the end of one novel, I start thinking about the next one because I have to leave it in a way that keeps the aperture open or the door open for the reader wanting to know what happens next, even though might be a year away. So I start thinking about that next one. What's going to be that theme? What's James Reese going to need? How's he going to need to evolve in that next one? So I start thinking about that a lot as I get to the end. Now I know where this next fifth one's going. So I'm excited to jump into that one too. But probably before I do, most of my effort over the next week will be on the last couple of scripts for the Terminalist series, which will star Chris Pratt, will be on Amazon. Anton Fuqua's directing, who's amazing, did Training Day, Tears of the Sun, Equalizer, Magnificent Seven, such a great guy. My next kind of, I don't guess, for the efforts over the next few days will be tightening up those scripts, and then we'll start filming here in 2021. So we shall see.
That's super exciting. I cannot wait. When I saw you kind of first mentioning that on social, I was pumped to see that that's going to be coming to Amazon. I think that'll be just absolutely fantastic to watch.
Eight part series, and I'm really excited with the way they're because it's a different way to tell a story, different medium, the written page, different than watching it on a screen. So I'm learning a ton about screenwriting, about telling stories through that visual medium. And I'm really excited about the direction. It has to be a little different because it's a different medium. So I'm really excited about the direction that it's taken. And it's just awesome. That's going to crush.
Will we be getting a lot of that hunting and conservation messaging even in the Amazon series as well?
Not as much as in the books. That's for sure. Yeah. You have such a limited amount of time. For me in a book, I can be, if I want to get to the end of a paragraph and I'm like, hey, you know, I want to explore that a little more. Guess what I do? I write another paragraph. but when you're doing these scripts, you have a certain amount of time that they have to fit and you have a budget. So for me, I can write about anything. It doesn't matter. I don't need to think about a budget as far as, if we're going to destroy a building like that, is that going to be expensive? I don't have to think about that at all. I just put it in there. In LA, especially now with all these COVID restrictions, if you're thinking about doing a scene that has a huge crowd, well, that is a significant consideration for the budget. So as you're writing these things, you have to think about that. If you have eight-part series that takes place in a crowded mall, well, that's going to be probably not going to happen. You're probably going to morph your storyline a little bit. So it's interesting how COVID has really crept into all aspects of our life, not just the health side, worried about relatives and whatever else, businesses closing and all the rest of it. I mean, it's affected every single part of our lives and really has changed the course of history. But in this specific instance, it's changed storylines. It's changed probably almost all storylines in Hollywood over the next few years, because you just have to take that into account. If you're doing something like Castaway or whatever, you're on an island, it's a little different. Like, you're good, you're fine. But if you have any scenes and crowds, well, you have to really think about that and consider what that means and how important is it to the storyline, and can we tell that same story another way?
And let's face it, however much I'd enjoy it, I don't think the public at large is going to enjoy a half an hour-long episode about.
There's some stuff in there. Yeah, no, you'll notice some stuff. You should notice some gear. And of course, this is my first rodeo as far as this stuff goes. I'm learning a ton. It's been awesome so far. The team they put together is amazing. But I'll be curious as I go through it, I'll learn so much more. And I'm typically a sponge. I always felt in the SEAL teams like I was a new guy, even at the end of 20 years. I was always learning. And I'm always learning here too. So I'll be very curious to see about, you know, the weapons and the gear and how you source that sort of thing. And, you know, whose prop house uses what, whose technical advisor likes what or whatever. So it'll be very interesting to see that dynamic as we start adding people. Cause at first it was just me and the screenwriter, Chris Pratt, Antoine Fuqua. So me and the screenwriter putting together the first episode, and then Chris Pratt, Antoine Fuqua, and the screenwriter going to sell it to Amazon, going to Netflix, going to Disney, going to HBO, all those. And then there was like a bidding war or whatever, and Amazon got it. So after that, they put together a writing room. So now you have like 15 people coming together to work on the next series of scripts. And they do their job for a certain amount of time, and then they go on to the next project. So now it's back to me, the screenwriter, Pratt, and director. And then now they're starting to cast. And then they'll start thinking about locations. Then they'll start thinking about all that gear and the prop houses and scheduling and all the other things that go, all the logistics that go into making a movie or making a series or whatever it might be. That's a lot of people. When I sit down to write a book, it's just me. So it'll be interesting to see, because every time, any time you add more than one person to anything, now you have a political consideration. You have early to consider. And then when you add 100 people, 200 people, 300 people, 1,000 people, and you're juggling all those different personalities and all the rest of it, it could get a little interesting. So I'm very curious to see how that plays out over the next year.
Well, so as we're winding down here, one thing I always like to kind of finish up with is, you know, say somebody was reading the novel, you know, and they're reading about the Hastings Ranch in Montana and elk stocks or mule deer stocks and all this stuff. And they're like, holy crap, man, like this is it. Like I've always wanted to do this, like hunting, but I don't have any background in it. I don't know anybody that does it. You know, my only experience with hunting and the outdoors is reading about James Reese and Rafe Hastings. Yeah. So maybe you hear about someone like that. What words of advice would you give someone that wants to get into hunting, but maybe is kind of intimidated by it? They don't know how to even start.
Yeah. So it is a tough, because it can be intimidating, especially if you don't know anybody. There's no one you can personally reach out to and be like, hey, you hunt, right? How do I get into this thing? Like, I really want to provide for my family, but I didn't grow up with firearms. I'm not sure. I heard you have to get a tag or something, and you have to like wait 10 years or the, like, there's all these questions for the person that is just starting down that road. And so I totally get it. It can be totally confusing. But I think it's always important to remember that, or they get online and they see all this gear and then they look up, how much is that bow? Oh man. How much is that rifle? Oh, that's really expensive. So yeah, we have to remember that back before the internet, back before social media, you know, people went out with a hand-me-down 30-30 or 30-06, probably the two rifles that have killed more deer, been used to kill more deer in this country than any other two calibers that had been handed down to them. They went out in jeans, cotton socks, work boots, and a red flannel. Like, and they went and they got it done, you know, in the winter, in blizzards. So it's important to also be like, okay, we did it like that. We got it done like that. Maybe I don't need a $10,000 rifle scope setup and this crazy amount of technical hunting gear, and then pay this private land owner this crazy amount to go on and put. So yeah, you can go that route, but you don't have to. And that's typically what you see when you log on, and your social media is an interesting animal, but it can also discourage people. It can encourage you and inspire you. Yep. But then you can look at some of these things that people are doing, be like, oh man, that's crazy. How am I going to ever do that? So it depends on your resources, just like anything else in life. You can do it with almost next to nothing. And the best way this is what I do. I don't know if this is right or not. I'd be curious what you have to say. What I typically say when I get that question is that, hey, like, do your research and find a local hunting club. Where do you start? Local bow shop. Shooting range, gun store type thing. And they go in there, they talk to those people in there, particularly in the bow shop, but find a time when they're not too busy. You know, if you ask when they're not going to be too busy, when you can go in and hang out and talk a little bit, definitely buy something, from those guys, because it's a small business. Maybe it's just a t-shirt or a hat, whatever, as you're just getting started. But, join a local hunting club. Doesn't have to be like one of these huge big ones or one of these very elite ones or anything like that. Some sort of local hunting club or like a 3D target place. And by doing that, you'll start to talk to people. You'll start to get to know people. you start to figure out, oh, how do you do this? Okay, I got it. And it's like anything else in life, it's just, it's relationships. So there's that way. If you have a couple more, a little more as far as financial resources, you know what? You can pick up and you can call FTW Ranch in Texas and you can go down there and you can do their beginning hunting course. And guess what they also have on that property? Oh, animals you can hunt. Guess what? They're exotic. So you can do it any time of the year. Yep, you got to fly down there. But guess what they also have there? A gunsmith, rifles, scopes, ammo, all of it. So you have a one-stop shop where you go and you take a class, you get behind the rifle, you learn how it works with the scope combinations, you learn your capabilities, and more importantly, your limitations with that chosen setup, and you go on a hunt. And then you're like, ah, I see that. And then you can start doing a little more research. Oh, where else can I go? What else can I do? But a lot of times you can go, not necessarily into your backyard, but essentially your backyard. And to figure out how that works, I think it's important to talk to people who have done it, who have spent time there, who kind of get the system, because each state is different. There's different, you know, obviously zones and things you have to do depending on the animal and how you're going to do it, whether it's muzzleloader or rifle or bow or whatever it might be. So I think a good first step, if you're not going to pick up and fly to FTW Ranch in Texas and get the full-on experience right out of the gate, is to head down, join that local 3D shooting archery course club, join that local hunting club, get to know people, start asking questions, get that bow set up, because you don't have to have that crazy expensive bow. You know, we didn't have those, you know, certainly 100 years ago people were getting it done, and they weren't spending this amount on these bows and these different setups or whatever. So there is something out there that is not as expensive. I'm not going to say it's not expensive, but it's not as expensive, and everything's relative. So everybody has a different perspective on what's expensive and what's not. So, but first step, yeah, go down there and talk to some of those people and be like, hey, I really want to get into this. I don't know how to start. And, you know, most of the time, they'd be more than happy to sell you a bow and talk to you about the different options. And you can be like, well, that, you know, I have $500 to spend. I have $300 to spend. I have $1,000 to spend. Whatever. Hey, how would you do it? That's what I typically do. I'm like, hey, if this was yours, how would you set it up? Or if you had $350, like, what would you do with it if you wanted to get started in this thing? And typically, somebody in a bow shop is going to be like, oh, this is what I do if I had that. So it's a very long way to go about it, but it's not an easy question. Just say, go to www.hunting.com and then just follow the instructions. Like, I don't think so. It's more personal than that. If that makes sense. And I'd be curious what you probably get that question a lot as well. I'm curious what you say.
I mean, it's just about word for word. What I say is find a local shop, find a local conservation organization that's having an event.
Typically the same type of thing.
Yeah. You know, you can't always afford. Sometimes the local shop might be a little bit more expensive than a big box store or Amazon or something if they're having a sale. But if you can, you know, go small, do what works within your budget as far as picking up gear, but make an effort to build community, because that's how, I mean, shoot, I started a damn podcast to build my community. Like, I didn't know anyone.
And all those resources, there's all those resources as well. There's your podcast, there's other podcasts, there's different people that you can follow and kind of get a tidbit here or there. Main point is not to get discouraged and to know, just like you said, go to that local shop. I mean, that's really what I tell people too. And then also, yeah, join that local conservation group or hunting club, and you're going to develop those relationships and you're going to build a base of knowledge, and then you're going to go out and then guess what? You're going to learn.
Yeah. And it's funny you bring up FTW Ranch, because I just had Tim Fallon.
He's awesome. I was just emailing him the other day. He's so great. Right.
Yeah. And I will be down there for their class in February.
Oh, nice. What are you doing?
I do not know. He signed me up, and I'm all like, right. All right, I blocked off the 4 or 5 days, whatever, for that weekend. And
nice. A buddy of mine, well, a couple of buddies of mine helped put together the course of instruction down there. A former sniper instructor of mine, and then a former buddy of mine who I went into Ramadi with in 2005 and 2006 as snipers. They're instructors out there now. So great group of guys out there. I mean, I learned so much. I can only imagine how much better of a sniper I would have been had I had that knowledge. And of course, you know, they're taking knowledge to now that 20 years military, and then all the different setups they see hunting wise, the people come through there with, they see every single scope, rifle, scope ring, ammo combination you can possibly imagine. And then they have everything there to fix something that's not working. So it's such a cool place, such a cool experience, great little bar in there. And it's just, it's awesome. I took my wife there for Mother's Day, which might not be the best move. when I came up with it, I talked to Tim and I'm like, hey, you know, do you have space in the class that runs through Mother's Day? And he's like, we tried that once. It didn't work. I'm like, what? It's a fantastic idea. Sign me up. Yes. Me, my wife, my daughter, we're coming out. It's going to be awesome. And then when I told my wife, she wasn't as excited as I thought she was going to be. But we went out there last year, the year before, I guess, before COVID. So 2019. It was awesome, but maybe Mother's Day or a wedding anniversary or your wife's birthday is not the best time to do that. Maybe do something else for that and then go. So anyway, it was awesome. We had a great time. We'll never forget that Mother's Day. I'll tell you that. So yeah, it was just us in the class and one buddy who was going to bring his daughter, and then she couldn't come at the last second. So, but FCW is awesome out there. Tim and that crew are just top notch. And, yeah, the range cards that you get, the amount of knowledge that you'll leave there with is, I learned something every time I go there. And then I also got to do, for that Mozambique trip, I went out there to get tuned up on a double rifle because I wanted to do my Cape Buffalo hunt the same way somebody would have done it 100 years ago. So I didn't want an optic. I used a 500-416 Nitro Express from Krieghoff, but I used, when I trained, I didn't have that rifle. So I used a Heim that they had out there. And it was just so cool how they train you up on that weapon system, and now they have these charging animals that come in or whatever, and you're reloading and boom. And then, you know, when I got over there to do the hunt, it was incredible. I could not have written how that thing went down better. And all of that training came into play, and it was really cool.
Awesome. Well, folks wanted to follow along with you and James Reese and the Hastings clan and all of the above. Where can they find you?
Yeah, so I have a website, officialjackcarr.com. And if people are interested in a little more background on some of the rifles that I used in SEAL teams or the knives in the books or whatever else, there's a blog. You can scroll through that blog and a deep dive. Some things I can't talk about in the book because it would only be interesting to a certain segment. that's a deep dive into those on the blog. I also have a reading list. I get a lot of questions about recommended reading lists. And so I pick six from my reading list, and I talk about six of them a month, and those are on there in the blog section as well, so people can explore that. And then I'm official Jack Carr, or no, I'm Jack Carr USA on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, but I'm most active on Instagram because three platforms is just too much for one person. So I think my Facebook just, I don't even know how to log in there, but it reposts from Instagram. And Instagram is where I'm there. I'm posting. I'm engaging. I'm trying to thank everybody, or at least hit that little heart as a thank you to people who reach out. Because I, you know, what made these things a success is it's the hunter, it's the tactical shooter, it's the veteran, it's the reader, it's that word of mouth that did it. Because I didn't go on Rogan until after the third novel was out, after it had already made the New York Times list. Chris Pratt didn't mention the series until after that third book, until after it made the New York Times list. Didn't go on Tucker Carlson until after that. So it was all grassroots. It was all word of mouth. It was all these different people, whether they have one follower or two or five or 10 million. It was, and everything in between. It was all these different companies that I had personal relationships with over the last 25 years, just by one being part of this industry and being wanting my guys to go downrange with the best possible gear that we could, and developing those relationships just naturally over time. Like they wanted to help launch these novels and like let their people that shoot their rifles or their pistols or use their knives know about it, you know, especially if it was in the novel, which a lot of times they are. So so that was pretty cool. So I try to thank everybody. It's getting harder and harder, but I still try at the end of the day just to go through and thank people, because I sincerely appreciate people taking a risk on me as a new author, then recommending me to a friend. Because when you do that, you risk something as well if the person doesn't like it. So I sincerely appreciate everybody doing that, and it means a lot to me.
And as a fan, coming from a fan perspective, it's very appreciated on our ends. Even just when you get, you know, when you leave a comment and you get that like, it's definitely appreciated. I know. And it's also a lot of fun going to your Instagram and, you know, because right now we don't have the series yet. But you said you occasionally get those little visuals that somewhat recreate moments from the book. And I think my favorite was the idea you posted an image, and it's kind of the recreation of that prologue, that first scene in the very first book. And people, you know, people can go figure that out and find it themselves. But awesome. It's a lot of fun seeing those pop up and be like, that looks like something I've read about before.
Awesome. Yeah. I try to, you know, add value. So before I post anything, or, you know, I try to think, hey, if someone is trusting me with their time, am I guess being a good custodian of that trust. And so before I post anything, I really think I'm just like doing a repost of a meme. I typically don't do that sort of thing. Cause I think people's time is their most valuable commodity, and they've trusted me with it. Even if it's just for a quick swipe, even if it's just for a second or two, that's still 2 seconds of their life. So I try to be thoughtful in that respect and post things that, that I put thought into and that I think add value, to someone's life that is following me. So I do take the time to think those through, and do that. Cause that's really where I get to engage today, particularly now that there's, you know, book signings aren't what they were, you know, of course, with COVID and all the rest of it. But I was thanking everybody well before that, and trying to engage with everybody well before that. Yeah, sincerely appreciate it.
Awesome. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time. I'm glad we got to make this happen. Looking forward to finding out what happens in the next book, and looking forward to seeing the series as well.
Awesome. No, thanks so much for having me on, and I love what you're doing. This is super cool. So let me know when it comes out, and I'll post about it, do all that stuff. But thanks for having me on, and thanks for being such a great voice for all of us out there.
All right, y'all, that'll do it for this episode of The Wild Initiative. Make sure to check out the show notes page at thewildinitiative.com. Get links to everything we talked about in today's episode. Big thank you to Jack for taking time out of his busy writing schedule to hop on the line with me. Make sure to keep an eye out for The Devil's Hand, the next book in the Terminal List series. Find out what happens to James Reese. And also keep an eye out on Amazon for the Terminal List series. I'm super excited to see that come out. But y'all, that'll do it for this week. Looking forward to next time. But until then, I hope this podcast inspired you to get involved, get outdoors, and plan your initiative for the wild.
Thank you for listening to The Wild Initiative. Please take a moment to leave a rating and review on iTunes or Stitcher, and head on over to thewildinitiative.com to get show notes, check out the blog, gear discounts, other podcasts from the Wild Initiative family, and more.